And Ziegler, I don't recall him particularly. Oh, he may. I was just thinking when I was. I remember when I presided at the bar convention, and I know this subject came up, and but I don't remember that. I don't remember the fellows from Southeastern being directly involved in our circuit. Being directly involved, other than perhaps on a "yeah, we agree" basis type thing, but really, as, you know, as far as being one of the driving forces, I don't think that was the case.
Someone like Bruce Schiebert, who was in on the McKay decision, I don't remember, and saying, "Well, of course, we were right." Or
no, I don't remember Bob being involved in it at all, as far as I can recall. May have been, but I...
Did Anchorage mobilize the rest of the state bar? Was that the position the Anchorage people were in?
Oh, I suppose, in the sense that the rest of the state bar sort of followed along. The rest of the state bar wasn't all that much, of course, in those days. I mean, in the sense of numbers. I don't remember anybody from Fairbanks, you know, charging down here and saying, getting really involved. But,
what about the vote against Terry Aaron for non-retention?
Yeah, that was a very unfortunate thing. Harry was a real nice person, a real good person, and I think he was a good justice on the court. I thought he wrote well. A very conscientious man, a very good man, nice, pleasant, you know, kind type of a guy. But yet he was a good justice. The question came up, of course, as to whether or not Harry was going to support the Chief Justice in his position. Not that it made all that much difference, I don't suppose. But at least that question was posed to Harry, and Harry said, yes, I support the Chief Justice. Well, he just unhappily was the first one up on the ballot for retention or rejection. And the bar mounted a very intense and well-organized effort.
What was the effort?
As I recall, we were just then getting into the magnetic tape typewriters, and a number of law offices, I don't believe ours did, put a form letter on their tape and sent it to every single one of their clients or people who had been clients, and said, this is bad, what they're trying to do here. And this fellow Aaron is going along with it. And as such, he's not qualified to sit on the Supreme Court. And it was effective.
Who composed the letter?
I haven't any idea. I have an idea it might have been probably a committee operation, of a group of people, I suspect. At least it was effective.
Do you know where a copy of the letter can be found?
No. I haven't any idea. I haven't any idea where you'd find one. See, this was all pretty well outside the formal bar association. The Integrated Bar Association.
They didn't do anything.
No. This was, well, I suppose it was somewhat involved with the Bar Association, but it was, a lot of it was sort of outside the Bar Association, or groups of lawyers.
When Renfrew came back in 1960,
Why couldn't he join back up with what was in Houston's force?
Oh, I suspect he didn't, because perhaps he didn't want to practice in the temple that we were. Also, I suppose he wasn't sure we would have him back. I don't know that, but...
He didn't even approach you then.
Oh, no. Not me, anyway. And I don't think... Bill really didn't want to practice as hard as John and I were practicing. John and I were practicing, you know, 5 and 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. And Bill simply didn't want to practice. And he had, as I say, I think he had a heart problem. And physically, he just wasn't up to it. And he practiced after that, and you know, with Bill Arnold and kind of on an office sharing basis, I think, but not the 8 to 5, 6 and 7 days a week business. No way.
Did you have his old clients, or did he get his old clients back? What happened to the clients?
Some stayed with us, some went elsewhere, some we were happy to see go. Bill didn't have that much of a clientele in the sense of a personal clientele. As I say, he did criminal work, some criminal work and some divorce work. But his commercial practice wasn't all that great. Well, he had a couple of clients that he was close to. And then he still did work for Milt. He and Milt Odom were great friends. And so we did some work for Milt after Bill left. And then when Bill came back, Milt went over to Bill and others, you know. And
did you have any affiliations with judo firms? Did you do any work with them, or did they do any work with you?
Not really. I think we pretty much operated on the premise if they had a problem, if we had a problem like, or had a case in Juneau, we'd have had, you know, send it to a Juneau lawyer to have him handle it. We weren't going to fly down there to Juneau. Because in, you know, in those days it was pre-jet, and that was even a longer trip than it is now. So we didn't have any.
What about Fairbanks?
Neither. We'd go to Fairbanks on occasion, and I tried a couple of cases up there. We'd travel up there and try cases, but no association with Fairbanks firms. Or perhaps, you know, nothing, certainly nothing formal. But Chuck Clasby up there, Mary Alice Miller, I know I tried a case with them. We were on the same side, I think. And but that was about all.
Were you involved at all with the Integrated Bar Act?
No, I think it came about, I'm sure Wendell Kay had a lot to do with the Integrated Bar Act. And I think maybe Judge Stewart did as well. And of course, this was all a fait accompli before I came to town, as I recall, anyway.
1955, the Integrated Bar Act.
Oh, was it 55? Well, you see, I was admitted in March of 55.
Yeah.
So I guess it came about the same time I did. But I kind of have the recollection that those were the people that were involved with the, you know, the enacting of the Integrated Bar Act.
Why did they want one?
I suspect so that they could sort of control their own ship. Rent themselves, maybe get the grading and get the exam giving away from the Attorney General, and disciplinary proceedings. Well, this may have had something to do with it, too, because when I came to town,
There was a big disciplinary proceeding going on. Discipline in those days was handled by the United States District Court. And the famous case of Harold Stringer, and J. L. McCrary was on the bench, and that out of that grew a contempt proceeding against Dave Talbot, and a lot of activity going on. And see, all disciplinary proceedings there, and that at that time was, were to the United States District Court. And so I suspect the bar maybe was interested in getting that changed somewhat.
Made less public.
Oh, I wouldn't say less public, but at least handled. I have an idea that the bar generally, and perhaps uniformly, felt that disciplinary proceedings shouldn't be handled by the federal district court, and that they ought to be handled the United States District Court, and they ought to be handled by the lawyers themselves, like they are in most other states. So I suspect this was the motivating factor. And
was it the political sense of the lawyers to get the power to make it so that they had power over themselves and not somebody else?
I think so. But you know, I think they were conscientious in that regard, though. You know, it wasn't simply a protective group. It was that, you know, we feel this is something that lawyers ought to do. We're going to do it. We can do it better than the United States District Court and prosecuted by the United States Attorney's Office. You know, and so that we can do it better. Now, individual lawyers may have had different ideas as to what they might accomplish. They might feel might have had selfish ends of their own. I don't know. They never expressed them to me. But as once again, as I recall, I was we had local grievance committees, and I was on a local or the local grievance committee. I think there was myself, Russ Arnett, Jim Tallman, and Roger Cremo. And as a matter of fact, we heard the situation initially as far as Neil McKay was concerned. And we then certified it to the Board of Governors. They in turn, we were sort of a probable cause finder, sort of almost like a grand jury type of thing. And we found unanimously, I believe, probable cause. Went to the Board of Governors. They appointed a trial committee, and then the hearing was held. That's the way it operated. And I suppose we had they must have had a local grievance panel, much in the same way we have now in each area: Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, Southeast.
How did you find time to be on the grievance committee and
It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy.
Feel it was important to serve on
almost.
Like that.
Well, I guess maybe Ed Davis may have been partially responsible. Ed was a very conscientious guy as far as the bar was concerned, and he may have been a prime mover in that Integrated Bar Act too. Because Ed was very active in the American Bar Association and in the Judicature Society. And so he may have been instrumental in getting me to get on this grievance committee. It seems to me Judge Fitzgerald put the arm on me to sit on it. And so, but I thought it was something that lawyers ought to do. And still do. I've made full circuit. I'm back on the panel again now.
Yeah. Over the time you've been practicing, and we haven't gone into the 70s and 80s, the oil years, what have been the major changes in the bar, the major things that you've seen page at the bottom?
Oh, I don't know that there have been that many major changes, except in the sense of size. We have many more judges. We have many more lawyers. We have much larger firms. The law has been changed by the Supreme Court to not only make possible, but in my estimation, to encourage litigation. And consequently, there is a litigation explosion that just won't quit. I suspect that's perhaps the biggest change, really. I think we've had good quality lawyers in Alaska for a long time, and I think we continue to have good quality lawyers, and we will.
Are lawyers as involved in the community as they used to be? I know you marked their predicate in politics before.
Oh, I think so. In perhaps many different ways, there's still a number of lawyers involved in politics in the sense of running for the legislature or for the governor's job or, being judges and that sort of thing. They're active in the bar. The Anchorage Bar is quite active, really. Anchorage Bar used to be, when I first came here, it was quite a fun organization. In those days, they were fighting with Judge McCary, I remember we used to meet up at the Jade Room in a banquet room they had off to the side there, and this one old guy, Herman Ross, big guy from Alabama, and he was a sole practitioner, and his wife was his secretary. And the story was that he never lost an account receivable yet. And Hummon would come to the bar luncheon just before Christmas and bring a bottle of Jack Daniel's Sour Mash whiskey and pass it around. And everybody would take a drink or two or whatever until it was all gone. And Hummon wasn't accustomed to such generosity. And that was his one time of the year when he'd come to the bar luncheon. Well, he'd come other times, but one time he'd bring a bottle of whiskey. We'd sit there and pass it around and talk and tell stories and whatnot. But then Ed Boyko screwed that up because we were passing the bottle around, and Boyko told a story, and he picked the locale for the story as, I think Herman was either from Alabama or from Mississippi. And anyway, he picked the locale that Herman was from, and he told this story. It was a funny story. And it wasn't terribly dirty, a little off color, but Herman took exception, got up, put the cap on his bottle, and walked out the door. That's the last time we ever had a free bottle of whiskey at the bar lunch before Christmas. So I think lawyers are active in community affairs. Many of the people in our firm, are very active in various sorts of activities. And social activities throughout the spectrum in the city. And bar activities and the various. I had one partner served on the Judicial Council for a while, and I served on the Qualifications Commission for about 8 years. And Mary Hughes is on the Board of Governors now. She's going to be president next year. And Ken Jacobus, he's very active in the Anchorage Bar Association. Jim Powell was on the Board of Governors one time, I think.
pretty sure. And Brundine was active with the university. So, you know, I think they're just as active as they always were. Hopefully make some contribution.
Have you ever applied for judges?
No, I haven't. And probably for a number of reasons. I suppose the closest I ever came was one time when a federal judge position was open. And a number of people were asking me to take it. And I wasn't sure I wanted to do that, but got a lot of urging here and there, and went so far as to go over and talk with Joe Croninger, the then clerk of the United States District Court. I talked with Judge Vonderheide, but after considering it, I decided I wouldn't take it. So they appointed Judge Fitzgerald, and that's all to the good, because I think Fitz is a good judge. Well, for the same reason that I didn't put my name in for a number of other judicial appointments that were open, that I really think, looking at it objectively, I probably could have gotten. I think I probably could have. The politics were right. I'm a Republican, and there was an opening on the Supreme Court one time when Wally Hickel was governor, and I suspect that I wanted to and worked at it, I perhaps could have gotten that appointment. I don't know. There were times on the Superior Court bench when I suspect, had I put my name in, I could have gotten it. I think probably the primary reason that I didn't take any judgeships was because I think being a judge, either a trial judge or an appellate judge, particularly a trial judge, would be extremely frustrating to me. And I think I might compromise my position in being an impartial judge by sticking my nose into the trial too much. I've been practicing law for some time, and I've always been an advocate in the sense that I was representing one side of the lawsuit. And I've done that a long time, and I kind of enjoy that. And I suppose much prefer being an advocate on one side or the other rather than trying to go down the middle. And I think I'm much more comfortable in that position. And I think I do a better job as an advocate taking one side or another, as opposed to being a judge and being impartial in the proceedings, not taking sides and going down the middle. I've been in that position, you know, in some of the bar activities and that sort of thing, and I think I've done a reasonably good job and kept a sense of objectivity about me as far as my determinations are concerned. But I just think that you sit in the trial court and you have all kinds of lawyers come before you. And I think that lawyers who came before me who perhaps weren't prepared or weren't as capable as I thought they should be, you know, I would find that extremely frustrating. In the appellate court, I think it would be boring. I think that's why Judge Fitzgerald went to the United States District Court. I think he was bored sick reading over those voluminous records and briefs and writing opinions. And I always enjoyed research when I did it and had time to do it. But I don't think so. And then to some extent, perhaps minor, I think judges, some justifiably, but some not, are getting an awful lot of flack from the media, because they don't do what the media thinks they ought to be doing. As I say, in some cases, I think it's entirely justified. But and I see things in that to me are just atrocious. And any criticism they get, they've earned it. But there's a lot of it otherwise. For example, the bar poll, you know, that gets published. And you see, sometimes I've seen lawyers, well, I don't hear one not too long ago, a lawyer, I think it was Bob Oplin, on the ratings, on integrity. He was just zapped. And I've dealt with Bob Oplin many, many times. And I may have other criticisms of Oplin, but not in the area of integrity. If the guy tells you he's going to do something, he's going to do it. And that sort of thing. I don't need that. I don't need that.
And, but what about the elected, having elected judges? How do you feel about that push to have elected judges?
I think it'd be a good idea. I really do. I can see the problems, because I think they're too insulated the way they are. The Missouri plan simply doesn't work. And, you know, as Chief Justice Benowitz found out when he talked to the Association of Trial Judges when they were up here that time and told them that we have the Missouri plan and we're out of politics, they just laughed him out of the hall. And that's true. Don't tell me there isn't politics in the selection of our judges. It's a lot of nonsense. Of course there is. You aren't taking them out of politics. No way. I just think it'd make them more responsive rather than every, Superior Court judge every 4 years, Supreme Court now every 10 or something, maybe 6 for the Superior Court judges. That's too long, in my estimation. I think the public ought to have a look at them. And I think some lawyer ought to be able to stand up and say, look, I think this guy's doing a lousy job. I think 156 Sundays for 4 pounds of Coke is terrible. And I don't know why he did it, but perhaps he'd like to tell you about it. And, that sort of thing. And, you always run into the problem. I was in Texas a few years ago having lunch with a guy down there. And he introduced me to a fellow, and he says, he's one of our Supreme Court justices. And he says, he's running for re-election. He says, I just contributed $3,000 to his campaign. That is a problem. That is a problem. I don't know how you handle that. I really don't. But these other things are problems, too.
Just a question about firms. From the 1950s, we were talking off the tape about Arnell and Plummer and Arnell. Mm-hmm. The only firms that have continued all the way through to the present that were started back in early times is your firm, Delaney Wiles from Arnell.
Mm-hmm.
But not from Plummer, and
are now Burr Pease and Kurtz.
Are those the only firms that go to date back?
Well, yes, I think that's true. I think that's true.
There aren't any other?
Well, in Anchorage.
In Anchorage.
Southeastern, of course. Yeah.
Two, really.
Well, and then Ziegler Claudia, that outfit, that was been there a long time. I think that's true. I think that's true. But that's gone, for all intents and purposes. They don't have a firm anymore. Clasby's has some association with Rice, Hoppner, et al. I suppose the parish office up there is, Bob was there when I came here and had been there for some time and then was with his sons. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What was he like to have a case then?
He was very tenacious. I think he was a hard-working lawyer. I was not terribly impressed with his legal knowledge. I thought was very repetitious in his presentation of evidence, but I think he had a idea in mind, and was allowed to do it. So, and he was successful, you know, in many respects. Many of his trials, he was very successful.
He was called the dean of the prison laundry bar, or at least he has a reputation for being that. Being on the other side, was he your most feared opponent, or were there others who were better at that sort of thing?
Oh.
Then I'm talking about territorial.
Yeah. I don't know how much contact I had with Bob in territorial days. Later on, I did. John Savage, who came here in territorial days, was a plaintiff's lawyer and a very good plaintiff's lawyer. Wendell Kay was a good. You say, I'm sure when you say the most feared opponent, you're saying in the sense that you're the most respected from the standpoint of ability and so forth. No, I wouldn't say that. I would say Wendell was probably a much more respected opponent. I tried three cases with Wendell. And the first one when I was quite early in practice, and it was a bad case as I look back on it, but he just wiped my nose. And then things got better as we went along. But, you know, Wendell's a very capable lawyer. You can disagree with a number of things about Wendell, but as far as his ability as a lawyer, he's good. Furthermore, as far as trying a case with Wendell, you didn't get any cheap shots from Wendell. He tried on the evidence, and he knew evidence. Wendell was a bright guy, you know, a real bright guy. You know, I did and do disagree with him on many other things and things that he's done and positions that he takes, but the hell, it's up to him too. You know, he probably disagrees with some of the things that I do and the positions that I take. So we each reserve that prerogative, but. You know, from the standpoint of ability. And then John Savage was a very capable lawyer, bright fellow, Harvard graduate, and a bright fellow, honest man. You try a case with John, there were no cheap shots coming around. And, so, you know, from ability standpoint, I think they outranked Parrish 2-1 at least. Bob had a big reputation in Fairbanks because, well, he probably did more personal injury work than anybody else, by far. And so.
It was said that the first judges that were appointed after statehood, it was split between the plaintiffs and the defense side. Did you ever hear that theory of how they were appointed? That you could go down
the road? Yeah. I would tend to discount that. Ed Davis, for example, came out of our firm. But I never really considered Ed a defense lawyer in the sense that he was a fellow who did a lot of insurance defense work, because he didn't. Ed did mostly trial work. I mean, mostly commercial work. Corporations, probate, partnerships, commercial ventures, agreements, contracts, things like that. And I don't remember Ed handling much, if any, personal injury defense work at all. Jim Fitzgerald, he was city attorney. Cooper. Earl was a politician. He'd been a judge at Nome because he was a politician, because he was a Democrat, a Democrat president, Democratic governor. He got appointed, longtime legislator. Earl was a character. I mean, God, you know, I have laughed more with Earl Cooper that I've laughed at with or about anybody. I tried one case with Earl one time. It was a divorce case. It was the funniest thing. God, it was something. But Earl, you know, really, Earl was no mountain of a lawyer in the sense that he was a highly intelligent, capable lawyer as such. Good guy. You know, Coop was a great guy. But, you know, but he had a point because he was a good, loyal Democrat. That's all, pure and simple. Not because he was, and Earl didn't do much, if any, plaintiff's work. Ralph Moody, he didn't do any plaintiff's work or defense work, as far as I know. Once again, Ralph was a bank lawyer. Worked for the, did work for City National Bank, now Alaska State Bank. Who else? Eben Lewis. Eben worked for Robison. They did mostly commercial work over there. Maybe an occasional plaintiff's case, but very seldom, really. You know, I don't think so. I didn't see that. Yeah, you know, there were efforts in that regard. Let's put it that way. There were efforts to stack the judicial council. And I recall attending an indignation meeting, which blossomed into a larger indignation meeting, and the Board of Governors was told to replace this one guy. I forget even who it was. Yeah, I guess it was Harold. Yeah, it was Harold on the judicial council with somebody else. Yeah, then Ray Plummer went on, right? Right. That's correct. And... but that was, I suspect that was more because of lack of faith in Harold, partially at least as a result of that grievance thing that he went through.
And he was extremely political,
wasn't he? Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Big. He was a big Republican, but Harold figured as a Republican he had to work with those Democrats, and he did. He and Wendell were great friends. Oh, yes, yes, yes. You bet. Yeah.
Passion and Prejudice, it wasn't really 250,000. It should be 500,000 because it was excessive. Now, all during the course of this case, the Sturm Ruger has been arguing that punitive damages is unconstitutional because there are no standards set upon which punishment can be imposed, and that this is a violation of due process, analogizing to criminal cases requiring notice and standards and that type of thing. What the Supreme Court has basically done is proven that Sturm Ruger is right, and Sturm Ruger has taken the case up to the United States Supreme Court on the question of punitive damages in itself has been taken up by Sturm Ruger to the U.S. Supreme Court on constitutional grounds. I don't know if the Supreme Court will hear it or not. If there's any single case where punitive damages is a sexy issue to be looked at by the U.S. Supreme Court, this is it. Because the lower court, the Supreme Court of Alaska, could not even agree on how to apply punitive damages. There's also another question in this case, and that's how do you treat punitive damages when you have a multiplicity of lawsuits? Sturm Ruger had not only this day lawsuit, but they have lawsuits against them all over the country resulting from this particular revolver. They have half a dozen lawsuits in the state of Alaska resulting from this particular revolver. The particular attorney who tried the case for Day has a number of lawsuits involving this particular revolver. And how do you handle it when the defendant is punished in the first case for what he did? Does he get a multiplicity of punishments in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth case? Etc. So that question again makes it a sexy question for the U.S. Supreme Court to look at if the Supreme Court does want to. Okay, off the subject of damages, and we'll be running through some of these next subjects kind of quickly. Owners and Occupiers of Land, page 14. One case to remember, or one principle to remember, Webb versus City and Borough of Sitka. Classification of trespasser, a licensee, and invitee to determine the duty of a landowner to one entering upon the land is abolished. We no longer have in Alaska trespassers, licensees, and invitee classifications. We look at general negligence again. The landowner must act as a reasonable person in maintaining his property in a reasonable condition in view of all the circumstances. Likelihood of injury, etc., burden of avoiding the risk, all the types of things that go into general negligence. A former possessor of land is not liable for injuries unless he actually concealed or failed to disclose to his buyer, the present possessor, what the condition was which would involve the unreasonable risk, and the present possessor does not know about the condition. The past possessor has a duty to disclose something he knew about, and you look at it again in terms of general negligence principles. The Webb versus City and Borough Sitka case dealt with a lady who tripped over some cracks in the sidewalk at the city of Sitka. There are older cases in the state of Alaska dealing with the city of Anchorage, and they hold that Anchorage has no obligation to remove natural accumulations of ice and snow from the sidewalks of the city of Anchorage because there's a lot of snow, it falls all the time, there's a lot of sidewalks, that type of thing. I would suggest that even though the case does hold that, the older cases, that you still have to, you won't get to that result as a matter of law anymore. You'll still have to look at it in light of general negligence principles, i.e., should the city of Anchorage have moved the snow, removed the snow, look at it that way. Comparative negligence. An important area of law which you will see on the bar exam almost certainly. Comparative negligence principles are not too hard in the state of Alaska. In 1975, contributory negligence was rejected in the state of Alaska, and the pure form of comparative negligence was adopted by judicial decision. And that was in the case of Katz versus State. That's another of the old friends here that you should know by name, Katz, K-A-A-T-Z. When the Supreme Court decided Katz and adopted pure comparative negligence by a judicial decision, which, by the way, I think was only the second jurisdiction in the United States to adopt comparative negligence by judicial decision. Some of the other states had adopted comparative negligence of one form or another by statute. But I think California was the first by judicial decision, and then Alaska followed California. Katz's case was followed in quite a few cases after that. In cases both before and after, specific defenses, in addition to contributory negligence, were disposed of. We no longer have the defense of last clear chance in Alaska. The fact that the person had the last clear chance to avoid the accident is simply something which is to be taken into account in determining comparative negligence. We also do not have the doctrine of assumption of risk in Alaska. Assumption of risk was disposed of even prior to comparative negligence in the contributory negligence sense, and the court held that assumption of risk is also something to be taken into account in the comparative negligence analysis. Now, there's some problem. Yes?
By comparative negligence, you're saying that the plaintiff is found to be 90% responsible for the injury. He still gets 10% of the total cost.
He gets 10%, right.
Sure.
Right, that's pure comparative negligence. Right, and there's a problem in the assumption of risk area, because assumption of risk and comparative negligence are philosophically two entirely different things, and it's difficult to lump them together as a matter of philosophy, because one really doesn't have to do with negligence. One has to do with assumption of risk is putting yourself in a dangerous position knowing what you're doing, or you should have known what you were doing and putting yourself in that position. It doesn't really have anything to do with the accident itself taking place, proximate cause of the accident. You merely placed yourself in a position of danger. So philosophically, that's different from from negligence and proximate cause, but the Supreme Court has lumped them together and said that you look at everything that happened, basically, in calculating the comparison of negligence between the parties. Last clear chance, by the way, can be argued as a matter of advocacy in closing argument, i.e. the person was more negligent because he had the last clear chance to avoid the accident and he didn't. That can be said properly. Or that the person assumed the risk of doing this and therefore he's more negligent. It's proper to argue that too. But the separate defenses, assumption of risk and last clear chance, are not available for instruction to the jury. Now, no specific guidelines are set forth by the court for apportioning negligence. The best guidelines they have set forth are set forth on the bottom of page 15 of the outline, which came from COTS 2. And they're set forth as a matter of making the apportionment process a little bit more concrete. You can take a look at them, but basically they deal with the probability of the harm occurring and the accident taking place, the foreseeability of the harm and the accident in the eyes of the people who were involved, what was gained by each party by doing what it was that he did, and whether there were reasonable alternatives available. Comparative negligence in Alaska is pure form. Basically, if the plaintiff is a percentage negligent, the plaintiff's entire damages are reduced by that portion of negligence attributable to the plaintiff. Logically here, to skip in the outline a little bit, it's logical to go from comparative negligence to the subject of contribution and joint and several liability. That begins on page 23 of the outline. Subject of contribution and joint and several liability is a little bit complicated in Alaska. It's basically governed by the Uniform Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act, which is available to you in the statutory supplement, 0916010. Please read this and become familiar with it before you go into the bar examination. I believe that the Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act is a complicated enough and sexy enough area to write an excellent bar examination question on it. Running down the statute, 0916010, there is a right of contribution between defendants whether or not judgment has been entered against both defendants. The right of contribution exists only in the favor of a tortfeasor who's paid more than his pro rata share of the common liability. Now, you go further down into the statute that defines pro rata share. And basically, in determining pro rata share between joint tortfeasor defendants, you do not consider the relative degree of fault. Okay? Example, plaintiff defendant 1 and defendant 2. Plaintiff is 50% negligent, defendant 2 is 30% negligent, defendant 1 is 20% negligent. Pro rata share between the two defendants is not based on that 30-20 split, because that's the apportionment of the negligence between them. Pro rata share is equal. Okay? Pro rata share between defendants is to be determined without regard to the fault of the defendants. This is set forth in the statute. It's also set forth in the case of Arctic Structures versus Wedmore. In addition to not considering the relative degrees of fault between the defendants, the collective liability of a group of defendants can be considered as a single share if equity requires that. This is the statutory language, and I have never seen a case either in practice or before the Alaska Supreme Court where this has been applied, that the collective liability of a group was classed as a single share. Yes?
Can a defendant get indemnity
for that? There's another section in here, F, which talks about the chapter does not impair any right of indemnity under existing law. If one tortfeasor is entitled to indemnity from another, the right of the there is still a right of indemnity and not contribution. So you still have a right of indemnity independent from the statute. And if you do have the right of indemnity, that's not limited by anything in the statute. So the right of indemnity is still available. On determining pro rata shares, again, there's another thing which talks about the principles of equity applicable to contribution generally shall apply. And I don't know why they put that in or what that means. It just says it.
There's something about being able to group. It looks like it leaves it open for the court. If you had somebody who was 5% negligent and somebody else was 95% negligent, that they would just drop that person out, not make them pay 50%.
where it talks about the principles of equity and the right to group.
I don't think it means that, though. No. I think that it might mean that grouping, if equity requires the collective liability of some as a group constitutes a single share. Okay, it doesn't mean that you're going to drop out the guy who's 5% negligent.
What if you had two that were 5 and one that was 90? Couldn't you group the two that were 5 as a single share?
If equity required it, you might be able to. Yeah, but again, you know, all I can tell you is what the statute says. There are no cases. As we go down the right to contribution, there's no right to contribution in favor of any tortfeasor, as we discussed before, in intentional torts, who intentionally caused or contributed to the injury. If the person did it intentionally, either as an intentional tort or as something which would be deemed intentional in the area of negligence, i.e., that's not really the right way to say it, but which would be deemed intentional by, example again, I guess, being very far, driving your automobile at 60 miles an hour into a crowded group of pedestrians, something which would be really gross negligence, which would rise to the level of being intentional. Again, I've never seen any of those cases. Liability insurer, which you won't get on the bar exam, it's subrogated to the tortfeasor's right of contribution if the liability insurer has paid. There's another principle here which you should be familiar with, section 0916040, and that deals with releases and covenants not to sue. When a release or covenant not to sue is given in good faith to one of two or more joint liability defendants liable in tort for the same injury, it does not discharge the other tortfeasors for liability unless its terms so provide. That the release reduces the claim against the others by the amount of the release or the amount of the consideration paid for the release. Okay, if you settle with one joint tortfeasor as a plaintiff, your claim against the other joint tortfeasors is reduced by that amount. However, there's a quid pro quo for that for the settling tortfeasor, and that's the tortfeasor who settles is released from liability for contribution to any of the other tortfeasors. If a defendant settles with the plaintiff in good faith, the plaintiff's claim is reduced, and the tortfeasor has protected himself from contribution claims by the other defendants. The tortfeasor who settles is out, and the other defendants can't come after him for contribution. They could still come after him for indemnity, however, because indemnity is not affected by the contribution statute. There are certain limitations in here which I won't go over in detail, which have to do with times for enforcement of contribution. Contribution oftentimes is enforced by a separate action. Indemnity is oftentimes enforced by a separate action, rather than by raising it as an issue in the action brought by the plaintiff. There's a practical reason for this, because when a number of defendants are involved in litigation with the plaintiff, they all want to present a united front. The defendants want to sit down and all point at the plaintiff and say, you did it, it's your fault. The plaintiff would rather have all the defendants in there pointing at each other. And the defendants don't want to do that. So even if you have the indemnity and contribution issues in the same action, very often they'll be settled or separated out in some way so that it's simply plaintiff versus all the defendants jointly. If you'll give me 1 minute here to change the tape.